I invite you to open up your Bibles to the book of Exodus, chapter 20, and we will begin looking there in just a moment. If you are visiting here with us this morning, let me echo Stan's words in saying we are delighted that you are here with us and glad to have you worshiping with us this morning in songs and prayers and now in studying God's Word, and hopefully we will know more and draw nearer to Him as we study, continuing our study through the Old Testament stories, now getting into the next period. We left off a couple of weeks ago with Jacob and his wrestling with God, and so taking on the name of Israel. Of course, then, after that, Israel, what is making up Israel at that point, which is just 70 souls, goes down into Egypt, and now we are looking at the time when they come out of Egypt. And we'll come to that in just a moment. Before I get into the lesson, I did want to just make mention, in Travis's prayer, he mentioned the preaching abroad. That's going to be happening very soon. Some of you probably already know, but in a couple of weeks from tomorrow, my brother-in-law, Seth Malden, and I will be getting on an airplane to head back to Fiji. And we're looking forward to being with the brethren there. They're making preparations. We are as well, and we solicit your prayers for that. A couple of weeks after I get back from there, Nevitesh is going to be coming here, and he got his visa and passport and everything recently, and all of that is cleared, and so we're very thankful for that, and he'll be here during our meeting with Brett Hoagland and then be speaking for us the Sunday following that meeting, and so I'm very looking forward to the opportunity for him to meet you all and for you all to meet him, to know more of the man that we're supporting in the work over there in Fiji. So I pray your blessings on that trip as well. In Exodus chapter 20, is the giving of the Ten Commandments. And so the Exodus has already occurred, but we're going to be looking at the Exodus as a whole this morning. I think that thematically speaking, the Exodus is one of, if not the most prominent themes in the Old Testament. In fact, I think that it would be similar to what Paul says, I preach Christ and Him crucified. I think in the Old Testament, you could say, I preach Israel and her delivered from Egypt. It is over and over and over. I think there's no theme more frequently referenced after you get past Exodus chapter 12 than that God delivered Israel from Egypt. He identifies himself. In addition to saying, I'm a God of grace and mercy and love, something that goes along with that repeatedly over and over. I'm the God who delivered you, who brought you up out of Egypt. And we'll see those references over and over in just a moment as we look at just a few of those. The word Egypt comes up over 600 times in the Bible. To put that into perspective, the word, the name of Moses comes up just a couple of hundred more times. And so it's almost at the same level of the name of Moses that Egypt gets mentioned. Now, I know not every one of those is a reference to the Exodus. Sometimes it's calls of judgment and so forth. But most of them, the vast majority of those are references. Even if you go back into the book of Genesis. So in Genesis chapter 12, we see Abraham going down into Egypt. So you say, well, that's not a reference. I don't know. Because he goes down into Egypt in the midst of a famine and then comes back up to the promised land. Is it not perhaps a reference to the Exodus? And certainly as we get over into Genesis chapter 15, there is the much more pointed foretelling of the sons of Abraham going down into captivity and then being delivered from Egypt there. And so even before the Exodus occurs chronologically, we're seeing all of that. I might add to that one more thing, that the people reading the book of Genesis for the first time as Moses wrote that were the very people who had been delivered from Egypt. And don't you know, when they saw Egypt, they were thinking of the Exodus. When Abraham went down, when they were reading about that story and so forth. And so I think we need to appreciate that. But a lot of those themes of the Exodus get carried over into the New Testament, and we want to concern ourselves with that as well. I think it's a well-known story. We're not going to go over the details this morning. We're not going to read all the way through the plagues in chapter 12 and the Passover and the the crossing of the Red Sea. We're going to make reference to all of those. I think you know the story. But I think like a lot of stories, it's easily brushed past, or at least it may not make the impact that it ought to make. I certainly think that's what happened with Israel. Is it just no longer made the impact? Maybe they just heard it over and over and over, and it just didn't hit them like it used to, like it ought to have. We were walking through a museum the day before yesterday, and it was the Lincoln Library and Museum up there in Springfield, Illinois. And they had depictions of slavery, and they had an auction block, and a woman and her child are being carried this way while the husband and father is being dragged away in the other direction. Family split up. They had the lashings represented on the backs of the slaves. And it was horrible to look at. And this little 12, 13 year old girl comes in. She goes, "Oh, it's so sad." And I was like, well, that sounds a little bit light for, yes, it is so, so sad. She was quickly moving on to another part, and I don't begrudge her. She probably gave more attention to it than I would have at that age. I just mean, but I think that's sometimes how we look at the Exodus. Wow, that's really neat. And then we move on. And we fail to grasp the depth of what God is communicating in the Exodus. He's not just delivering of people. It's not just an interesting historical record, but it is a record that is teaching something, and it's meant to impact us still today. I want to look through it, first of all, as foundational. We talked a few weeks ago about the creation being foundational. And we see, like the Exodus, that the creation is referenced over and over again. That this is the God who has created all things. That we see that throughout the Old Testament. We see that as we get into the New Testament, as Paul is preaching about God, especially when he's preaching to pagans, he references the creation. So it's fundamental to understand that. You don't understand who God is if you don't understand that he's the creator of the world. Can I suggest to you that it is as much the case about the Exodus as it is about creation? Maybe more so. I don't know that it's maybe comes underneath the creation more foundationally, but it's certainly more prevalent as far as reference goes. It's referenced far more often than the creation. And it's referenced in very similar ways to the creation. In other words, that God is creator is a characteristic of God. It's who he is. It's an identifier. That God delivered Israel from Egypt is an identifying characteristic of God. To begin, Exodus chapter 20 that I asked you to turn to a moment ago in verse 2, Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, as God is delivering the Ten Commandments, he begins with this: "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." And so he begins this most well-known portion of the law. It is established on the beginning of "I delivered you from Egypt." And so that is a bedrock. It's a bedrock of everything else God is going to say throughout the law. In fact, as you continue to read through the law, he's going to bring this up again and again. It influences the very specific commands of the law. In Exodus chapter 22 and in verse 21, it says, "If, however, he survives," Exodus 22 and verse 21, that's chapter 21, verse 21. Exodus 22, 21, it says, "You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." And so he calls them to look back to Egypt and their treatment in Egypt as a reminder for how they treat their neighbors. Again in chapter 23 and in verse 9, Exodus 23 and in verse 9 there he says, "You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger. You are also strangers in the land of Egypt." And so he's asking them to take their memories both before and after the Exodus, and to put that into practice, to apply that in their lives. And so he brings those laws together and says, think about it in these terms. Well, over in Leviticus chapter 19 and in verse 36, Leviticus chapter 19 is filled with a phrase, "I am the Lord your God," or "I am the Lord." And so from the very beginning of that chapter all the way through the end, God is giving just a number of laws, and they're varied and sundry laws. In fact, I think some of your translations, that'll be the title, Sundry Laws. I like that. And so that's the way chapter 19 is. It's hodgepodge. But what's interesting is what draws all that together is God saying, do this. Why? Because I'm God. Do this. Why? Because I'm God. And some of them are connected. In other words, don't serve idols because I'm God. Well, that makes sense. But then it's like, leave the corner of your field. Why? Because I'm God. That doesn't make as much sense except to say that I have the right to tell you these things. But notice he says, in addition to I am God, in verse 36, you shall have just balances and just weights, a just ephah and a just hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. Going along with the establishment of the Ten Commandments, saying I'm the God who brought you out of Egypt. Here again, it almost seems disconnected. You know, what does bringing them out of Egypt have to do with just balances and weights? I am telling you what to do. Who are you? I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt. I have every right to tell you what to do. And so it just lines right up there with the creation and the authority that the creation brings to the table. This deliverance brings authority to the table. People ask sometimes when someone is speaking with authority, somebody's telling someone, what right do you have to tell me what to do? I'll give you an example. You know, when either it's parents and children or even adults and benefactors. In other words, someone who's been given stuff is told how to use that stuff by the one who gave it. And they might say, what right do you have to tell me? I'm the one who gave it to you. We say that to our children sometimes. You know, they may challenge our authority. Now, my children have never said, what right do you have? They don't go that far. They imply it on occasion. And I'll say, I'm the one that the stuff comes from. Right? And so you don't have stuff if it's not me giving it to you. You're out in the cold and you're starving to death. And that's not to puff me up, but it is to establish authority. And God establishes authority that way. I'm the reason you're not in slavery right now. So you listen to me and all the rules that I have to make. And so it is a foundation of authority. It is a foundation, of course, of God's covenant with his people. Over in Leviticus chapter 26. Leviticus chapter 26, and there in verse 45, it says, but I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. I think very often when we see that I might be their God, there's the implication that they would be my people. It's sort of like half the phrase and the other half being implied. But that I shall be their God and they shall be my people is that covenant language that we see over and over and here and in other places repeatedly. It is attached to, I brought you out of the land of Egypt. That is the very beginning of the covenant coming into full force, really. We might go back to Abraham and the promises made to Abraham. That's the beginning of the covenant. But now the covenant's really coming into fullness. Right? It's been promised. It's established. It's a done deal, we might say. And yet, now, really, they've entered into the covenant because now they are a nation. And now they are a people with land, or at least soon will be as this law is being given. It speaks to that thought process of being in the land and those covenants being in full force. Another place where the Exodus gets laid alongside the creation is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. You might recall in Leviticus chapter 20 when the Sabbath was being commanded, and repeatedly after that, as the Sabbath continues to be communicated in the law, that it is connected to the creation story, that God created the world in 6 days and the seventh he rested, and therefore the Sabbath day. You will remember it and keep it holy. But in Deuteronomy chapter 5, there's a repetition of the Ten Commandments. And in that repetition, he says, first of all, he again establishes it on the notion that he is the one who delivered them from the land of Egypt. But then as he gets to the commandment of the Sabbath, he says in verse 12, observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your ox, your donkey, or any of your cattle, your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath. The Sabbath, the rest of the Sabbath, there's two elements, I believe, to that rest. There is, first of all, looking back to the creation, and God's rest, and we're following his example. It's like God said, I knew that you would need rest, so I showed you that even I would take rest, so that you would know that. But then there is, I gave you rest. Right, you were slaves and you were servants, and I gave you rest, and I want you to remember that and keep that in mind. And so there is the creation, and then there is also the notion of the release from bondage. I think that's a theme of the Sabbath, the release from bondage that we would see carried over into the New Testament when Jesus is performing miracles on the Sabbath. One of the miracles that he performs is a woman who had been bound, and it uses that language. That she, it doesn't say she was crippled, it says she had been bound. And he says, he sets her free. It doesn't say he healed her, it says he sets her free. And all this on the Sabbath. And I think that the people should have remembered the foundations of the Sabbath with that language. And it should have dawned on them who Jesus was and what he was doing. But they didn't get it. They lost the connections. You see, the Exodus is a story that they knew. But they didn't see its significance and its importance in that way. And so we want to appreciate that. We want to appreciate those connections that they did not and take them to heart. Again, it is used as a constant reminder. There's so many passages we could turn to. I think one of the more pointed ones is in the book of Haggai. In Haggai chapter 2. And there in verse 5, it says there, as for the promise which I made you when you came out of Egypt, my spirit is abiding in your midst. Do not fear. And so as Haggai is encouraging them back to the work, he says, I want you to think all the way back. Now think about this. This is in the return from captivity in which, incidentally, the language gets elevated. A lot of Exodus language in the return from captivity. But here they are, so far removed from the Exodus. And in fact, in some ways, they've got a new Exodus story. And he could appeal to that and be talking about God bringing them back from the Babylonian captivity. But he goes all the way back to the beginning. And he says, don't you remember the promises I made you then? I've not changed. My promises are still in place. I'll still keep them. And he's still inviting them to what he invited them to from the very beginning, as he created them as a nation. I think, when we get frustrated sometimes that people do not appreciate, the history of our country, that people don't appreciate, the 4th of July except as an opportunity to eat lots of food and blow things up. And we say, you know, there's so much more going on there. We feel like people ought to be more appreciative and thankful and grateful for all the blood that has been shed so that we might be able to have a country like we have. Here are people who had a country that was established alongside their church. They are one and the same. Their relationship to God and their relationship to country is one and the same. What a precious thing it should have been that patriotism and spiritual fervor could have gone hand in hand. For us, it's a little bit of a competition, and we have to be careful that our patriotism doesn't rise up above our spiritual fervor. I was thinking when my dad was reading, I Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb. If I just said I pledge allegiance and then just left that open, what would you fill it in with? And as he read that, I thought, oh, how easy it was as he read that to just put away the flag and think of the Lamb alone. but it would be easy for it also to be competitive. Here there is no, there should be no competition. And yet with such unified thought and such unified opportunity for them to think on their history and not to have to think about it in contrast, but in unison to their devotion to God, it still failed. It still failed. And so we need to be careful we do not follow after that same failure of forgetfulness and seeing all that God's deliverance has to communicate to us. His deliverance of them, and in just a moment we'll talk about his deliverance to us. There is a lot of symbolism in the Exodus with Israel being brought out of Egypt. In the book of Hosea, there is a reference that is, I think, familiar to us, that I called my son out of Egypt. And in Hosea chapter 11 and in verse 1, when Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. That will be taken up by gospel writers, and as Jesus and his family fled down to Egypt and then came back into the promised land, just the same as Abraham had done, just the same as Israel had done, it calls this passage and then applies it to Jesus. Now, obviously, Hosea says when Israel was a youth, and so it speaks very pointedly and primarily to Israel, but then it speaks beyond. It says I'm talking about more than Israel. But now we see that with Israel in general. If you go back to Exodus chapter 4, in Exodus chapter 4, and in verse 22, it says there, then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. Now that's very pointed language. And you don't have to go, well, now I just don't see the connection. If you don't see that connection, then, well, let's get a Bible reading program started. That's so obvious. It's so on the face of it. And so Israel is representative of Jesus. But it is an imperfect representation. It is a terribly imperfect representation. And what Jesus does when he comes is not only fulfill that representation and become the antitype of Israel's type, but he becomes perfection of what they ought to have been. There's some more subtle places in which the connections to Israel and Jesus are indicated, I believe, and Luke chapter 9 is one of those places. Luke chapter 9 is Luke's account of the transfiguration. And in that transfiguration, we see Jesus, you recall, there with Peter, James, and John there on that mountain. And Jesus is surrounded on each side by Elijah and Moses, and they are all shining. And it says that they were talking with him. Behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. The word for departure there, the Greek word, I'm going to tell you don't have to know a lick of Greek. Go look that Greek word up. It is spelled E-X-O-D-U-S. And you don't even have to know Greek letters. They look it close enough. You'll figure it out. So they were speaking to him of his exodus, which was to be accomplished. I don't think those kind of words are just thrown around. There's a lot of other words, in fact, that could be used, other Greek words that would mean departure. But he says exodus. Jesus is going to accomplish what they did not. He is not only going to exit the wilderness and go into, he's not just going to exit the wilderness, he's going to go on into the promised land. He is going to cross the Jordan where that people did not. I might just add to that in Jesus' fulfillment of all these things. It's something that I've been thinking more and more on lately, and that is that when we think of the law, we need to be so careful that our mind does not go to the Pharisees. that we don't think of them as representations of the law. And in fact, not even to Israel as a nation. They are poor representatives of the law. If you want to think, is there anyone who perfectly followed the law? Yes. That is Jesus. Sometimes we think of the Jewish people and we think, yeah, that's what the law gets you. No, if you follow it, Jesus is what it gets you. And so by looking at Jesus, I hope we have a greater appreciation of what God did in setting up and establishing that nation. And we look at Jesus and saying, there's what it could have been. People go, I wouldn't want to live in that country. Boy, that would be harsh and difficult. Well, it wasn't supposed to be. It was supposed to be a wonderful place, full of wonderful people, following the best of all laws that has ever been given. And so Jesus is a perfect representation of Israel. And he will not only be delivered, not only perform an exodus, but he will also go on into the promised land and show us the way into that promised land. Of course, the other elements of the story, the Passover lamb is a type of Christ. You go back and you read Exodus chapter 12. I've known that there's a connection. It's a very obvious one between Jesus and the Passover lamb. But we were studying that in Montgomery. And we studied it in some detail with more focus than I had before. And after we had studied that, Eric Huey got up at the Lord's table and decided to read Exodus chapter 12. And after you've been thinking very deeply about those connections, you read Exodus chapter 12. It's hard. And he barely made it through it. And we barely could listen to it. Because what we realized is that when God is putting that Passover lamb in place, again, like in so many cases, he doesn't come along later and go, you know what? I think I'll use that as a good example. No, he is communicating to them what he's preparing to do. Don't you know God has known the whole time? They say sometimes that the worst part about something bad happening is the waiting. God has known the whole time that he's going to offer that Passover lamb. And he delivered the words to a people who did not appreciate it, who sacrificed those lambs so many of those generations that even if they followed it at all, they did it unthinkingly and uncaringly. Of course, we could do the same thing. But he's telling them about the lamb that he will ultimately bring that will, as John said, take away the sins of the world. Of course, Israel also represents us. And maybe they do a better job of representing us than they do representing Jesus. There are ways that they obviously do connect to Jesus, and yet in their failures and their constant rejection and their need for deliverance, we are the ones that they represent. And the New Testament writers would use that very frequently. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I think, is one of the most impressive places as far as, you know, just bringing out all the connections, not all of the connections, but so many connections right there. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, he says, that our fathers who were all under the cloud all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. And the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. The notion of them being the same as we are. It's a very important concept for a number of reasons. Don't just think of this as generic history that you can learn from, right? I mean, in your high school and college history classes, you know, those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it, and so we can make generic connections. That's not what Paul is saying. He's saying spiritually, you guys got a connection. This is the same process. Don't try to separate yourself from these people. And here's one of the most important, I think, applications that we can take from the Exodus is that's us. And what he says here is, yeah, but look, we're so much more spiritual. No. Same spiritual food, same baptism. You need connections. Do you need me to connect the dots so you can see how much like them you are? Your relationship's the same. And so you can fall the same way. All of this in 1 Corinthians 10, it's in the context of people wondering about whether or not they should eat the meat sacrificed to idols and take that a step further, whether or not they should actually go into the temple of the idols and eat that meat, as he gets to discussing here at the end of this chapter. And there are people saying, we got this. We can handle this. And he said, no, you can't. Let me point back to a whole nation of people and show you what all they had. And they could not handle it. Not even for a moment, because this passage he's quoting is from Exodus chapter 32. They rose up to play. They couldn't handle it. And don't think that you can either. Don't think you're so much better than them. I think sometimes when we go through difficulties, when we fail, when we stumble, we legitimize it. We in some way make excuses and try to say, imply at the very least that our failings are rational, right? It's understandable that we failed because fill in the blank, or at least they're nuanced and they're not so clear cut. We look back at Israel and we say, what folly. How absurd these people are. They are us. And our sin is no less absurd. And when you think about your sin, think about how silly you think that they look when they have just crossed through the Red Sea and they turn around and say, where's the food? They look ridiculous. So do you. So do I. When I sin or I don't trust God. When they get to the mountain and they see it's surrounded by storms, by clouds and thunder and lightning, and they felt the shaking of the ground and seen Moses go and come and communicate with God, and then they say, this isn't working. Let's make something to bow down to. You think insanity. It is. And so is your sin. And so is mine. It's insanity. And here it is laid out maybe a little bit more clearly for us and saying, here's what that looks like. You don't know how silly you look? Here's some stories. This is how silly you look. It's how sad you look. And so we need to internalize that and not put those degrees of separation between us and them. Over in Hebrews chapter 3. In Hebrews chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. He says, therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. As in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brethren, that there be not in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God, but encourage one another day after day, as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm to the end. While it is said today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me? For who provoked them? For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that he would not, that they would not enter into his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Therefore, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them, because it was not united by faith in those who heard. For we who have believed enter that rest. Just as he has said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although his works were finished from the foundations of the world, he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage, they shall not enter my rest. Therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day, today, saying through David, after so long a time, just as it has been said before, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. If Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. Do you see how tightly he's weaving our story with God with their story with God? And he said, don't let the end of your story be the same as the end of their story. And I do love that he says, look, God said there would be a rest. They didn't get it. Therefore, there must still be one out there. And it's the one that's waiting on you and me. It's the real Sabbath. The real rest. The real deliverance from worse bondage than Egypt could offer. Our relationship to God is the same as theirs. Over in Jeremiah chapter 7. In Jeremiah chapter 7. It says there in verse 21. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifice and eat flesh. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice and I will be your God and you will be my people and you will walk in all the way which I commanded you that it may be well with you. It's so interesting to me that Jeremiah is essentially making the same argument as the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 4. They think it's on circumcision and the sacrifices and the rituals kept with calendar precision. And he says, if it's circumcision, then how was Abraham saved? And here are people bringing empty sacrifices and God says, go ahead. Why don't you just eat them? If you go back to the beginning, what did I say to the people? I didn't even tell them about sacrifices. That wasn't the basis of our relationship. The basis of our relationship is you listen to me. You do what I say. And then you'll be my people and I'll be your God. We'll get along real well. And so it's not a specific thing in history, a moment where God says this one thing and that's what you hold on to. It's you listen to everything he says whenever he says it. And you do that and that'll be the foundations of your relationship. Actual faith will be the foundations of your relationship. I think we can see that as God called them out and brought them out of Egypt, plundering Egypt, though they had no military capabilities. They were sent on their way with riches, all the riches of Egypt. And they had done essentially nothing. All they had done was kind of wait. And of course, exercise the faith by killing the lamb and putting the blood on the doorposts and the lintel. And then in chapter 14, he brings them to the shores of the Red Sea. And in verse 13, it says this, Moses said to the people, do not fear, stand by, he says, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you this day. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. He preaches what sounds like inactivity. You don't do anything. You sit there and you be quiet. You sit there and do nothing. God's going to take care of this. And in a way, that's absolutely right. Now, moving 2 million people across any kind of land, much less land bordered on both sides with waters that look awfully strange, must have been difficult. But on the grand scale, what is it? Nothing. God's doing all the work. He's the one that's delivered them with a mighty hand. And nobody would have gotten to the other side, or at least no sane person would get to the other side and go, whew, we showed them. And so it is the same with you and your baptism. That when you come to God and you do something and you participate and you agree to His terms, that essentially what you're doing is you are standing by and watching the salvation, and you are keeping silent while He delivers you. You don't have the power. You don't have the capacity. You can get into that water. Why, sure, I can do that. I can walk to the other side of this Red Sea. But that's nothing. It is just doing what God has asked us to do. What about you this morning? Do you see how foolish they are? As you continue on after Exodus chapter 14 and you see one gripe and complaint and challenge of God after another, as you see their failures, does it seem absurd? It always did to me in Bible class. I thought, these people are ridiculous. They are. Do you see that you are too? Do you see your own sin with as much ridicule and scorn as you might look at their sin? And do you see them rejecting Him at Sinai and again at Kadesh Barnea? And if you shake your head, I hope that you shake your head at your own sin. You look not only no less foolish, but even more foolish. For you have more invested in your deliverance than God had invested in their deliverance. And I hope that you will see your deliverance with as much impact as they were supposed to see theirs. You may be a Christian this morning. You may have gone through those waters of baptism and eaten the same spiritual food and drunk the same spiritual water. But maybe like Israel, you've heard so much about it, it just doesn't have the impact anymore. God meant for it to keep impacting them. Generations, not just in their own lifetimes, but generations later, He ought to have been able to say Egypt, and they ought to have bowed their heads in reverence and awe. And so, a lifetime away from your conversion, it ought to be that somebody speaks of the blood of Christ, and it cuts to the heart. And if it doesn't, then I hope that you'll open your heart again, and that it may be cut again, and brought to awe and reverence at the very mention of God's deliverance, your exodus from the bondage that you were in. If there's any way that we can help you reconcile yourself to God this morning, won't you come forward while we stand and while we sing?